Here in Isaiah 11, once more, verse 10, we're looking at, there's a significant change in lots of things. It's signaled by the phrase, then, in that day. So there is, an obvious time frame that's being spoken about. And I think it's the millennial kingdom, but that's, neither here nor there from, what I think, but I do see it as being that. I don't see this as something that's going to take place before that. So there's a universal spread of the true knowledge of God, and that's the work of Messiah, who is this root of Jesse, comes from the stump of Jesse. He is a shoot, a branch that grows out of a tree trunk that's been cut off. And so therefore starts out as being not really very significant in the sense of the world, but he becomes everything. He was of no account. In this section, the big difference is he's of a lot of account. That's the opposite of that. But he's exalted like a banner or a billboard or a huge sign. And that's just, of course, a word picture. More important than that. He's going to draw attention, going to become a place where everybody is. He doesn't become a place, but he becomes where he is, everybody comes to. The nations turn to him with their questions, and they want to know what he thinks. They want his wisdom. They want his royal judgment. And that's actually, I think that becomes actually how they operate. He's pictured as king, and they are talking to one who is inspired by the spirit of wisdom, according to Romans 11:2. It's then that they actually voluntarily submit to him, which is a whole different scenario, and to his government. And this is all about the instruction of the Lord coming through the king, who is the teacher of nations and Messiah. And of course, this sounds to me like his name is above every name, and his place where he lives is all glorious. And all the treasures, it seems, later on in Psalm 72:10 and Revelation 21:24, if I'm correct about the millennial kingdom, are going to be brought there. So it is verses 10 through 11 in chapter 11 of Isaiah that are a transitional set of verses. They're linked with verses 1 through 9 by virtue of the same subject matter and some words. So there is an attractiveness to the messianic king that's being spoken of here. Brings the people of the world together, just as the Lord himself attracts nations in darkness to his marvelous light. And if you were going to finish reading Isaiah, you'd see that in Isaiah 60, verses 1 through 3. The phrase, in that day, is eschatological, as I pointed out, and it clearly speaks to the end times. These verses describe nothing like it is on earth right now or have ever been. But there is, in Isaiah's mind, a desire to see what happened or something of equal importance to happen, like the Exodus, when God stretched out his hand and delivered the people. And Isaiah looked forward to that time. And it has, of course, to do with redemption. And what he's talking about here contrasts with the Exodus, when in many ways, but the people that are moving in this section are moving individually rather than collectively. And instead of being led by a leader, Moses, of course, being a mediator-type leader, they are coming to the leader. There's a lot of difference in the movement itself, and even from the points of departure, but they come together from many lands and various points on the compass. So they're coming to a location, yes, but they're coming to the person of the Messiah that's referred to here, who is, of course, the stump, the branch of the root of David. Where they are said to be coming from, the places that they're coming from are located near or at the great river systems that have acted as, might call them, the beginnings of civilization in the Near East, the Tigris, Euphrates, and the Nile. The addition of the phrase islands of the sea is actually fairly surprising. The word island in the plural occurs frequently in Isaiah 40 through 66, and it appears like it designates the Mediterranean areas. The reference to dispersion of the Jews in this area is Joel 3:6, and of course it's not really something that everybody agrees about, but we do find considerable dispersion, Western dispersion, in the New Testament times. However, this is anticipated by the Holy Spirit. Verse 11 has this occurring on that day when the Lord will again recover the second time with his hand the remnant of his people. And they come from Assyria, Egypt, Pathros, Cush, Elam, Shinar, Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. So it's a remnant that returns. And they come from all these different places that seem to be in the Mediterranean areas, in the coastal areas where they are. And they are going to come back after having survived judgment and escaped oppression. That seems to be the lot of the remnant of all the lands that Israelites were scattered to. Assyria and Egypt, the world powers of Isaiah's day, are mentioned first. The names of other countries help to fill out the picture of the dispersion. Pathros is Upper Egypt. Ethiopia is further to the south, connected with the Syria or Elam, east of the Tigris and the Shinar, which is, of course, Babylon. Next is Hamath in northern Syria. And finally, Asia Minor and the Greek Isles and coast are mentioned last. The Lord's going to raise a banner for the peoples, and he's going to, in that way, give a sign to the nations, for they will be coming back home. Thus, from every side, he brings Israelites and Judeans, men and women, back to Canaan. Something significant happens when they come back, in that their jealousy of Ephraim will depart. In verse 13, those who harass Judah will be cut off. Ephraim will not be jealous of Judah, and Judah will not harass Ephraim. they're going to together go after the Philistines, plunder the sons of the West in verse 14. And they possess Edom and Moab, and the sons of Ammon are subject to them. So they're not only getting along now, they're fighting together. I mean, they're conducting military campaigns, it appears. I don't know how that fits into the millennial kingdom. These are things that have to be sorted out, and they're difficult, most definitely. But there is a different state of affairs, and that they are once again united and not hassling each other. They are able to decide on a common enemy and a common goal, and there is movement together. And these are general things, of course, prophetic things, predictive things, and so it speaks about a future time in that day, but it also could very well be specifically located in the millennial kingdom scenario. So, seems to me that these are people who have been converted, and they have been returned to Canaan. This is prophecy that's fulfilled on a higher level. When you think about this, and I don't know if we spoke about this during the time we were looking at Abrahamic covenant, but already in the New Testament, Judah's returnees are viewed as representing the 12 tribes. I think we did talk about this. Ezra 6:17 and Ezra 8:35. And the New Testament shows that the promises that are made to Israel apply to the church as far as Romans 11 and Galatians 3 and Ephesians 2 are concerned. So this is, in my estimation, the new Israel, 1 Peter 2:9, with the heavenly Jerusalem as its center, in Galatians 4:26, Philippians 3:20, Hebrews 12:22, in distinction from the Israel that is according to the flesh, 1 Corinthians 10:18. Now, all these things are very controversial, and things that you have to sort out yourself, and I'm only briefly touching upon them, but it is not necessarily a new group that takes the place of Israel, but Israel, as the people of God, had that position. And the position is now, what would you say, extended or continued in the New Testament church. There's not a change of the plan or anything like that. It is a development within the plan of God. So the promise is, this promise to Israel is fulfilled in the remnant chosen by grace, Romans 11, 1 through 5. Gentile Christians are grafted into the old olive tree, Romans 11, 17. But this is not incorporation into Israel as a nation, as it is with slaves and foreigners added in to Israel. So this is a pretty big deal, and to say the least. And the prophecy points to the salvation of the church of God received at Christ's first coming, and that will be received in perfection at his second coming. Especially important and salient is the experience of God's grace and the communion, fellowship of the saints. So, the exile is pointed to as a temporary separation of the church from God on account of its sins. The believer's unity and love and their putting away of envy and jealousy can be seen, as well as their inheritance of the earth and their being able to rule as kings. So all these splendid realities, I guess, are foreshadowed in this prophecy. I would like to say more, but I've gone long enough. I'm going to leave it at that. And until we see each other again, as I always say, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and give you grace. The Lord lift up his face or his countenance on you, to have God's face lifted up upon you or on you is a tremendous thing. It's a good thing, a wonderful thing, and give you peace. Shalom.